Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Today's show will be a singular listening experience. Lord knows we all enjoy picking up book 8, 9, or 10 in a favorite series. It's such fun to see what new trouble Jack Reacher, Alex Cross, Kay Scarpetta, or Kinsey Millhone have gotten themselves into. But sometimes we want to explore virgin territory, to meet new characters and be transported to unfamiliar places. Today's collection of standalones is an intriguing mix of dramas, thrillers, and mysteries. I have the pleasure of speaking with two stellar guests. Tess Gerritsen takes a break from Rizzoli and Isles, and Paula McLean writes about Aviatrix Beryl Markham. Let's discover these titles and more together as we turn to page one of the book report. Booker Prize-winning author John Banville is just out with The Blue Guitar, a study of the intricacies of artistic creation and theft, and about the ways in which we learn to hold on to ourselves. Equally self-aggrandizing and self-deprecating, Oliver is a painter of some renown. And he's a petty thief who doesn't steal for profit and has never been caught. But Oliver's pushing 50, feels like 100, and things have not been going well. Having recognized the man-killing crevasse that exists between what he sees and any representation he might make of it, he's stopped painting. And his last purloined possession has been discovered. The fact that it was the wife of the man who was his best friend has compelled him to run away from his mistress, his home, his wife, from whatever remains of his impulse to paint. He sequesters himself in the house where he was born and tries to uncover the answer to how and why things have turned out as they have. Jerry O'Brien performs the book.
What I want to say is this, that I have decided, I have determined to weather the storm. The interior one. I'm not in good shape, that's a fact. I feel like an alarm clock that an angry sleeper, an angry waker, has given such a shake to that all the springs and sprockets inside it have come loose. I'm all a jangle. I should take myself to Marcus Pettit for a pair. Ha ha. They'll be missing me by now. Over there on the far side of the estuary. They will wonder where I've got to. I wonder the same thing myself, and won't imagine I'm so near. Polly will be in an awful state, with no one to talk to and confide in, and no one at all to look to for comfort except Marcus, whose comfort she is hardly likely to call on, much given the state of things. I miss her already. Why did I go? Because I couldn't stay. I picture her in her cramped parlour above Marcus's workshop, huddled in front of the fire in the murky light of this late September afternoon, her knees shiny from the flames and her shins mottled in diamond shapes. She will be nibbling worriedly at a corner of her mouth with those little sharp teeth of hers that always remind me of the flecks of glistening fat in a Christmas pudding. She is, was, my own dear pudding. I ask again, why did I leave? Such questions. I know why I left. I know very well why, and should stop pretending that I don't. Marcus will be in his workshop at his bench. I see him, too, in his sleeveless leather jerkin, intent and hardly breathing, the jeweler's glass screwed into his eye socket, plying his tiny instruments that are, in my mind's eye, a steel scalpel and forceps, dissecting a Patek Philippe. Although he is younger than I am, it seems to me everyone is younger than I am, his hair is thinning and turning grey already, and see, hangs now in feathery wisps on either side of his leaning, narrow, saintly face, stirred by each breath he breathes, stirred a little, a little. He used to have something of the look of the juror of that androgynous self-portrait, the three-quarters profile one with tawny ringlets and rosebud mouth and disconcertingly come-hither eye. Latterly, though, he might be one of Grunwald's suffering Christs. "Work, Ollie," he said to me dolefully. "Work is all I have to distract me from my anguish." That was the word he used. Anguish. I thought it queer, even in such dire circumstances, more a flourish than a word. But pain compels eloquence. Look at me. Listen to me. The child is there, too, somewhere. Little Pip, as they call her. Never just Pip, always Little Pip. It's true she's quite small, but what if she grows up an Amazon? Little Pip, the gentle giantess. Oh, I shouldn't laugh, I know. It's jealousy jogging my funny bone. Jealousy and sad regret. Gloria and I had a little one of our own, briefly. Gloria. She'd slipped my mind until this moment. She too will be wondering where on earth I am. Where on earth? Damn it. Why does everything have to be so difficult?
We've just heard The Blue Guitar by John Banville. Tess Gerritsen took an unusual route to her writing career. While on maternity leave from her work as a physician, she began to write fiction. She published her first novel, a romantic thriller, in 1987, Call After Midnight. Tess's first medical thriller, Harvest, was released in 1996. She then went on to write the incredibly popular Rizzoli and Isle series, the basis for the TNT series starring Angie Harmon and Sasha Alexander. There are now 11 bestsellers in that series. Tess's books are found in bookshops around the world, with more than 30 million copies sold. I'm so pleased Tess is stopping by the program today to speak about her new standalone novel, Playing with Fire. Welcome, Tess. I'm thrilled to have you with us on the Book Report again, and I have to tell you, I read the book in two sittings.
Oh, good. Glad to hear that.
What was your inspiration for Playing with Fire?
It came from a nightmare. Never happened to me before. I mean, this is my 26th book, and I've never had a book inspired by a nightmare. But I was in Venice for my birthday, probably drank a few too many glasses of wine, and I dreamt that I was playing my violin. The music was very strange and disturbing. There was a baby sitting next to me, and the baby's eyes glowed red, and she turned into a monster. I woke up and thought, whoa, what was that about? I knew there was a story here, something about the power of music to transmit emotions, evil maybe. I was walking through the streets of Venice that day, and I ended up in the old Jewish quarter and saw the plaques to the, you know, in commemoration of the 246 Jews who were sent away from, you know, from Italy to go to death camps. And that's when the whole story came to me. So it was really about a dream, and it was about being in Venice and Italy at that particular time for me. It all came together.
Tell us about the book's two stories, the present-day one with Julia and the 1940s in Italy with Lorenzo.
Yeah, it starts with Julia, who's a violinist. She finds an old handwritten piece of music in a Rome antique store. Every time she takes it home to Boston, and when she plays the piece, it's called Incendio, her 3-year-old daughter goes berserk and commits violence, you know, stabs her mother. So Julia is now afraid of her own 3-year-old girl, which is crazy. I mean, who's afraid of a 3-year-old? But she wonders, is the music evil? Is her child possessed? Her husband thinks she's going nuts. To save her family, she has to find out what the origin of the music is, and she travels to Venice to look to find out who the composer was. And in her search, she uncovers the other half of the story, which is the story that's told starts off in 1938. It's really a love story, and it dates back to a very dark time in Italy's history, which was during the Holocaust. You see a family, and you see a man named Lorenzo and the woman he loves, Laura, and what happens to them. So that's the historical story, and this is really where Incendio is born in World War II.
In the book, Lorenzo has a treasured violin, La Dianora, the sorceress, passed down for six generations. And you're a violinist, isn't that right?
I am a violinist, and you know, there are things about that. You know, I mean, I describe the violin, how you hold it. Wood is a living thing. I mean, I always feel it's a living thing. So when you pick up a violin, especially an old violin, you sort of feel that everybody who's ever played that instrument has left some kind of trace of the leftover vibrations from the pieces they played in the wood. And, you know, violins, if you don't play them every day, they go bad. They need to be played. So there was something magical about picking up an old piece of wood that may be centuries old and feeling like you've inherited all the melodies that have ever been played on that instrument. I composed the music in Gendio, which the book is about, and it is performed by Suzanne Howe, who's a concert violinist, and that was the part she identified with the most in the book. She said that sense that you're playing a living thing, because she's playing she recorded the music I composed on a 1738 violin, and she feels that history in the wood itself.
And actually, that Incendio, for listeners of the audiobook, they'll be treated to hearing that composition, isn't that right?
Yes, they will be hearing a version of the composition, but the official composition, the official recording, is on iTunes and on Amazon, and you can hear a one-minute sample of it, Suzanne playing it on her 1738 violin. You can hear it if you go to my website at tessgerritsen.com.
Mm. Will you explain the devil's chords found in the piece of music?
Yeah, you know, when I was I had been describing this music in such detail that I think it got into my subconscious, and halfway through writing the book, I woke up with the melody in my head. It took me about 6 weeks to write the music. It starts off with this very sweet and mournful melody, but it becomes more and more disturbing. Now, you know, ask yourself, what makes music disturbing? It's dissonance. It's where notes don't sound, they don't play well together. And one of the dissonant chords that is well known is called the devil's chord. It's a fourth, it's a diminished fourth. What it does is it makes you feel uncomfortable. And this is the kind of chord that was forbidden in the medieval church. They just thought it was evil. So, of course, I had to use it in my composition, right? I mean, there's no way I could not use that, the devil's chord, in this piece of music.
We're speaking with Tess Gerritsen on The Book Report. You know, I learned it from your book that 250 Jews were deported from Venice in 1943 and 44, and only 8 returned. And in fact, 20% of Italy's 47,000 Jews perished in the death camps. While you were in Venice researching the book, what kind of Jewish community did you discover there present day?
It's very much scattered. I think that the Jewish community in Venice is quite a bit smaller than it was, and they're no longer confined to that one little section. Although a large number of the people who would live in that Conareggio neighborhood are Jewish. What I found most interesting, because I went to the Jewish museum there, that's in the Ghetto Nuovo, was the fact that number you just quoted, which was that 20% died during World War II in Italy. But what's interesting is that 80% survived. Whereas you go to Germany and Poland, 90% died. So how did 80% of Italian Jews survive the war during the Holocaust? And the stories I uncovered of how they were helped by local Italians, I think that was what was very uplifting for me in the midst of all this tragedy and this horrifying time, that there were so many ordinary heroes who risked their lives to save their neighbors, to save their friends, to hide them, to help them get to Switzerland. You know, a lot of priests and nuns did heroic things as well, hiding them in churches and in convents. And as a result, 170 priests and nuns were executed by the Nazis for this.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you think, if that ever happened to me, if I were given the choice, do I hide my neighbors in my basement and maybe have my whole family killed because of this, would I dare do this? It's a frightening question that we all would probably, you know, a lot of us would say no, a lot of us would say yes, but that's a form of courage that we're not often called to display.
Riviera di San Saba was an actual place, and I'd never heard of it. Will you describe it?
Yes, it's a transit camp that is now in modern-day Trieste, Riviera di Zanzaba. It was a rice husking factory that was converted by the Nazis to a temporary camp where when you collected all the Jews and you put them on trains to go to Poland, a lot of them would pass through this one transit camp. By 1944, it was turned into a death camp, an extermination camp, because they could not handle all these huge numbers of prisoners coming through, and they built their own crematorium. Mm. The story out of Riviera was that they would execute prisoners by by gunshot or by makeshift gas through various ways, but sometimes the prisoners were not dead, not fully dead, when they delivered them to the crematorium. Mm. And that was where music was played to hide the sounds of the screams. And I read that history, and I had already gotten this story in my book, but here was this, really confirmation that the story that I had come up with had origins in reality, and, really horrifying reality.
Mm. I read in your bio that during your childhood, your mother did something that sort of began developing your darker sensibilities. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, my mother was an immigrant from China, and she didn't understand English very well. But what she did understand and love was the American horror film. So she took my very young brother and me to every scary movie that Hollywood ever made. And I spent, a lot of my childhood screaming in movie theaters. I think I learned from that the height of entertainment was to scare your audience. And I think I've been doing it ever since.
You certainly do a fabulous job on it. What are you working on now?
I'm working on the 12th Rizzoli and Isles book, which will probably be released late next year.
Any final thoughts about Playing with Fire?
No, I just hope people will go onto my website to listen to a sample of the music Incendio, which was inspired by the book.
All right, Tess, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye now. And now let's listen to a sampling of Playing with Fire, performed by Julia Whelan and Will Dameron.
How do you trip and fall three times? He ignores my question. Instead, he picks up the murder weapon, a dandelion fork tipped with prongs, and asks,
"How did she get her hands on this thing anyway?"
"I was out here weeding last week. I must have forgotten to put it back in the tool shed." There's still blood on the prongs, and I turn away. "Rob, doesn't it bother you how she's reacting to all this? She stabbed Juniper, and a few minutes later she asked for juice. That's what freaks me out, how perfectly calm she is about what she did."
"She's too young to understand. A 3-year-old doesn't know what death means."
"She must have known she was hurting him. He must have made some kind of sound."
"Didn't you hear it?"
"I was playing the violin, right here. Lily and Juniper were at that end of the patio. They seemed perfectly fine together, until..."
"Maybe he scratched her. Maybe he did something to provoke her."
"Go upstairs and take a look at her arms. She doesn't have a single mark on her. And you know how sweet that cat was. You could yank on his fur, step on his tail, and he'd never scratch you. I've had him since he was just a kitten, and for him to die this way..." My voice cracks, and I sink into a patio chair as it all washes over me, a tidal wave of grief and exhaustion. And guilt, because I couldn't protect my old friend, even as he bled to death only 20 feet away. Rob awkwardly pats my shoulder, not knowing how to comfort me. My logical, mathematical husband is helpless when it comes to dealing with a woman's tears.
"Hey. Hey, babe," he murmurs. "What if we got a new kitten?"
"You can't be serious. After what she did to Juniper?"
"Okay, that was a stupid idea, but please, Julia, don't blame her. I bet she misses him just as much as we do. She just doesn't understand what happened."
"Mommy?"
Lily cries out from her bedroom, where I've put her down for a nap.
"Mommy!"
Though I'm the one she's calling for, it's Rob who lifts her out of her bed, Rob who cradles her in his lap as he sits in the same rocking chair where I once nursed her. As I watch them, I think of the nights when she was still an infant, and I rocked her in that chair, hour after hour, her velvety cheek snuggled against my breast. Magical, sleep-deprived nights when it was just Lily and me. I'd stare into her eyes and whisper, "Please remember this. Always remember how much Mommy loves you."
"Kitty gone away,"
Lily sobs into Rob's shoulder.
"Yes, darling,"
Rob murmurs.
"Kitty's gone to heaven."
"Do you think that's normal behavior for a 3-year-old? I ask the pediatrician a week later at Lily's well-baby visit. Dr. Cherry is examining Lily's belly, eliciting her giggles as he presses on her abdomen, and he doesn't immediately answer my question. He seems to genuinely like children, and Lily responds by being her charming best. Obediently, she turns her head so he can look at her eardrums, opens her mouth wide as he inserts the tongue depressor. My lovely daughter already knows how to enchant every stranger she meets. He straightens and looks at me.
"Aggressive behavior isn't necessarily something to worry about. At this age, children get easily frustrated because they can't fully express themselves. And you said she's still using mostly 3- and 4-word sentences."
"Is that something I should worry about? That she's not talking as much as other kids?"
"No, no. Developmental milestones aren't set in concrete. There's a great deal of variability among children, and Lily's progressing as expected in every other way. Her height and weight, her motor skills are all perfectly normal."
He sits her up on the side of the exam table and gives her a big smile.
"And what a good little girl you are. I wish all my patients were so cooperative. You can see how focused she is, how closely she pays attention."
"But after what happened to our cat, does that mean she might do something even worse when she's..." I pause, realizing that Lily is watching me and listening to everything I say.
That was Playing with Fire by Tess Gerritsen. Living on her family's gorgeous lakeside estate in Cornwall, England, Alice is a clever, inquisitive, innocent, and precociously talented 14-year-old who loves to write stories. But the mysteries she pens are no match for the one her family is about to endure in The Lake House by Kate Morton. One Midsummer's Eve, after a beautiful party drawing hundreds of guests to the estate, the family discovers their youngest son Theo has vanished. What follows is a tragedy that tears the family apart, leaving their estate as empty as their broken hearts. Now, 60 years later, having enjoyed a long, successful career as an author, Alice is 80 years old and living in London. Theo's case has never been solved, though Alice still harbors a suspicion as to the culprit. Miles away, Sadie Sparrow, a young London police force detective, is staying at her grandfather's house in Cornwall. One day, while out walking, she stumbles upon the old estate, now crumbling and covered with vines. Her curiosity is sparked. She seeks out Alice and uncovers shocking truths about a past long gone, yet more present than ever. Caroline Lee narrates.
As a skein of housemaids waving polishing cloths flew eagerly down the hall, she slipped through the doorway and hurried to the window. But where was he? Alice felt her stomach swoop, thrill to despair in an instant. Her hands pressed warm against the glass as her gaze swept the scene below. Cream and pink roses, petals shining as if they'd been buffed, precious peaches clinging to the sheltered garden wall, the long silver lake gleaming in the mid-morning light. The whole estate had already been preened and primped to a state of impossible perfection, and yet there was still bustle everywhere. Hired musicians slid gilt chairs across the temporary bandstand, and as the caterers' vans took turns stirring dust on the driveway, the half-assembled marquee ballooned in the summer breeze. The single static note amidst the swirl of activity was Grandmother DeShiel, who sat small and hunched on the cast-iron garden seat outside the library, lost in her cobwebbed memories, and completely oblivious to the round glass lanterns being strung up in the trees around her. Alice drew a sudden breath. Him. The smile spread across her face before she could stop it. Joy. Delicious star-spangled joy as she spotted him on the small island in the middle of the lake, a great log balanced on one shoulder. She lifted a hand to wave, an impulse and a foolish one, because he wasn't looking towards the house. Even if he had been, he wouldn't have waved back. Both of them knew they had to be more careful than that. Her fingers found the ribbon of hair that always fell loose by her ear, and she wound it between her fingers, back and forth, over and over. She liked watching him like this, in secret. It made her feel powerful, not like when they were together, when she brought him lemonade in the garden, or managed to sneak away to surprise him when he was working in the far-off reaches of the estate. When he asked after her novel, her family, her life, and she told him stories and made him laugh and had to struggle not to lose herself within the pools of his deep green eyes with their golden specks. Beneath her gaze, he bent, pausing to steady the log's weight before easing it into place atop the others. He was strong, and that was good. Alice wasn't sure why, only that it mattered to her in a deep and unexplored place. Her cheeks were hot. She was blushing. Alice Edervane wasn't shy. She'd known boys before. Not many, it was true. With the exception of their traditional midsummer party, her parents were famously reserved, preferring one another's company. But she'd managed, on occasion, to exchange surreptitious words with the village boys, or the tenant farmers' sons, who tugged their caps and lowered their eyes and followed their fathers about the estate. This, though, this was, well, it was just different. And she knew how breathless that sounded, how awfully like the sort of thing her big sister Deborah might say, but it happened to be true. Benjamin Munro was his name. She mouthed the syllables silently. Benjamin James Munro. 26 years old, late of London. He had no dependents, was a hard worker, a man not given to baseless talk. He'd been born in Sussex and grown up in the Far East, the son of archaeologists. He liked green tea, the scent of jasmine, and hot days that built towards rain. He hadn't told her all of that. He wasn't one of those pompous men who bassooned on about himself and his achievements as if a girl were just a pretty enough face between a pair of willing ears. Instead, she'd listened and observed and gleaned, and, when the opportunity presented, crept inside the storehouse to check the head gardener's employment book. Alice had always fancied herself a sleuth, and, sure enough, pinned behind a page of Mr. Harris's careful planting notes, she'd found Benjamin Munro's application.
We've just heard The Lake House by Kate Morton. Shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, longlisted for the National Book Award for Fiction, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara has been called the most astonishing, challenging, upsetting, and profoundly moving book of the year. It's an epic about love and friendship that goes into some of the darkest places fiction has ever traveled. When four classmates from a small Massachusetts college moved to New York to make their way, they're broke, adrift, and buoyed only by their friendship and ambition. There is kind, handsome Willem, an aspiring actor. J.B., a quick-witted, sometimes cruel, Brooklyn-born painter. Malcolm, a frustrated architect at a prominent firm. And withdrawn, brilliant Jude, who serves as their center of gravity. Over the decades, their relationships deepen and darken, tinged by addiction, success, and pride. Yet their greatest challenge, each comes to realize, is Jude himself. By midlife, a terrifyingly talented litigator, yet an increasingly broken man. Oliver Wyman performs the book critics have called a tragic and transcendent hymn to brotherly love.
The 11th apartment had only one closet, but it did have a sliding glass door that opened onto a small balcony from which he could see a man sitting across the way, outdoors in only a t-shirt and shorts, even though it was October, smoking. Willem held up a hand in greeting to him, but the man didn't wave back. In the bedroom, Jude was accordioning the closet door, opening and shutting it when Willem came in. "There's only one closet," he said. "That's okay," Willem said. "I have nothing to put in it anyway." "Neither do I." They smiled at each other. The agent from the building wandered in after them. "We'll take it," Jude told her. But back at the agent's office, they were told they couldn't rent the apartment after all. "Why not?" Jude asked her. "You don't make enough to cover 6 months' rent, and you don't have anything in savings," said the agent, suddenly terse. She had checked their credit and their bank accounts, and had at last realized that there was something amiss about two men in their 20s who were not a couple, and yet were trying to rent a one-bedroom apartment on a dull, but still expensive, stretch of 25th Street. "Do you have anyone who can sign on as your guarantor? A boss? Parents?" "Our parents are dead," said Willem, swiftly. The agent sighed. "Then I suggest you lower your expectations. No one who manages a well-run building is going to rent to candidates with your financial profile." And then she stood, with an air of finality, and looked pointedly at the door. When they told J.B. and Malcolm this, however, they made it into a comedy. The apartment floor became tattooed with mouse droppings. The man across the way had almost exposed himself. The agent was upset because she had been flirting with Willem, and he hadn't reciprocated. "Who wants to live on 25th and 2nd anyway?" asked J.B. They were at Pho Viet Wong in Chinatown, where they met twice a month for dinner. Pho Viet Wong wasn't very good. The pho was curiously sugary, the lime juice was soapy, and at least one of them got sick after every meal. But they kept coming, both out of habit and necessity. You could get a bowl of soup or a sandwich at Pho Viet Wong for $5, or you could get an entree, which were $8 to $10, but much larger, so you could save half of it for the next day, or for a snack later that night. Only Malcolm never ate the whole of his entree, and never saved the other half either. And when he was finished eating, he put his plate in the center of the table so Willem and J.B., who were always hungry, could eat the rest. "Of course we don't want to live at 25th and 2nd, J.B.," said Willem, patiently. "But we don't really have a choice. We don't have any money, remember?" "I don't understand why you don't stay where you are," said Malcolm, who was now pushing his mushrooms and tofu. He always ordered the same dish, oyster mushrooms and braised tofu in a treacly brown sauce, around his plate, as Willem and J.B. eyed it. "Well, I can't," Willem said. "Remember?" He had to have explained this to Malcolm a dozen times in the last 3 months. "Merritt's boyfriend's moving in, so I have to move out."
"But why do you have to move out?"
"Because it's Merritt's name on the lease, Malcolm," said J.B. "Oh," Malcolm said. He was quiet. He often forgot what he considered inconsequential details, but he also never seemed to mind when people grew impatient with him for forgetting. "Right." He moved the mushrooms to the center of the table.
"But you, Jude, I can't stay at your place forever, Malcolm. Your parents are going to kill me at some point."
"My parents love you." "That's nice of you to say, but they won't if I don't move out. And soon."
We've just heard A Little Life by Hana Yanagihara. Paula McLean was born in Fresno, California. After being abandoned by both parents at age 4, she and her 2 sisters became wards of the California court system, moving in and out of various foster homes for the next 14 years. When she aged out of the system, she supported herself by working as a nurse's aide, a pizza delivery girl, an auto plant worker, and a cocktail waitress. Then Paula discovered she wanted to write.
She received her MFA in poetry from the University of Michigan in 1996. In 2011, she published The Paris Wife, a portrait of Hadley Richardson, Ernest Hemingway's first wife. The book would become an international bestseller. Paula lives with her family in Cleveland. Today, we'll speak with Paula about her new title, Circling the Sun. Welcome, Paula. It's wonderful to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thanks, Elaine. It's my pleasure.
How did you discover Beryl Markham?
Oh, goodness. So a few years ago, I read West with the Night, which is Beryl's memoir of her adventures and her early days in Kenya, which was first published in 1942, that I actually wasn't aware of before a few years ago, nor was I aware of Beryl Markham. I had never heard of her, and I'd never heard of the book West with the Night. But the moment I picked it up and began to read, I was instantly fascinated by her and fixated to learn more about her.
Beryl's 1942 memoir, West with the Night, which we've just talked about, chronicles her journey as a pioneering aviator who became the first woman to fly solo east to west across the Atlantic. In doing the research for this interview, I found this quote from Ernest Hemingway to his publisher. "But this girl, who is to my knowledge very unpleasant, and we might even say a high-grade bitch, can write rings around all of us who consider ourselves as writers." After your success with The Paris Wife, did this quote help lead you to Markham?
You would think so. You would absolutely think so, because the letter that Hemingway wrote Max Perkins is now used as a blurb on the back of West with a Night, but I wasn't aware of it. I wasn't aware of it until after I had really begun to write about her. But it's a great connection. It's a great connection.
Beryl's mother abandoned her at age 4, the same age your parents abandoned you and your sisters. Didn't that make it very difficult for you to write this book?
Quite the contrary. I think that my sharing this bit of emotional DNA with Beryl really helped me get closer to her, to understand the forces driving her, driving her character, driving her choices. In West with the Night, Beryl doesn't talk about her mother's abandonment. In fact, she never mentions her mother, which to me is a very loud silence. And I had a real understanding of how someone who is motherless might push back against the universe. And Beryl is an incredible underdog, right? I mean, something traumatic like that happens to you. You can either lie down, right, and be a victim, or you can get up and dust yourself off. And Beryl never pitied herself. She really didn't. She attacked the world and rather fearlessly, in fact. And I really admire her for that.
I was kind of stunned to read in the book that her brother had been living in Africa for several years and never reached out to her.
Well, family is a very strange thing, but that's something I understand a lot about myself. I really do. And particularly her relationship with her mother, which is also quite unresolved. Her mother leaves when Beryl's 4 and comes back when she's 20. Those are my exact dates. And my relationship with my mother is very unresolved as well. It doesn't tie up neatly in a bow.
How did you do the research for this book?
Well, it started with West with a Night, and then there were so many gaps and absences. Beryl doesn't talk about her mother, as I've just mentioned. She doesn't mention that she was married 3 times. She doesn't mention that she's a mother and that she doesn't raise her son. She doesn't mention Karen Blixen, who she was involved with in a love triangle with the safari hunter Dennis Finchatten. So I began with West with a Night, but to fill in the blanks, I had to go to biography. Beryl didn't write a lot of letters, so I had to go to Karen Blixen's letters. Karen Blixen wrote her mother every Sunday for decades, and they're incredibly detailed letters. So I know a lot about Beryl.
You know, in speaking about Karen Blixen, so many people adored Meryl Streep as Karen Blixen in the movie Out of Africa. Was it difficult to have readers embrace Beryl when some believe she stole Dennis Finchatten from her?
Well, I do seem to be destined to write about love triangles, and obviously this is a big thing in The Paris Wife. And with this book, strangely, I identify with and sympathize with the other woman. So Beryl is a rival for Finchatten. And in a way, you know, I've had readers come up to me at events and say, "How dare you ruin one of the greatest love stories in history?" But really, to me, it's not ruined. It's more complicated. The fact that it's more complicated doesn't mean that Finn Chatton didn't love Karen, and it didn't mean he didn't love Beryl.
We're speaking with Paula McLean on The Book Report.
I loved your writing about Kibi. Could you introduce him to the listeners who may not have read the book? And was he based on an actual person?
So, yes, he was. Kibi is Beryl's best childhood friend. He is a character in West with the Night as well. He's a young boy who grows up in a tribal family, the Kipsigis tribe on her father's land. And he is a warrior in training. And when Beryl's mother leaves when she's 4 years old, she gets sort of swept up with Kibi's family and his tribal system, and is allowed a very privileged position to also be, for a time, a young warrior in training with Kibi. And they are fierce competitors and confidants. And he really is one of the most significant relationships of her life.
How much truth is there to the relationship that Beryl had with Prince Harry, third son of King George V? I was intrigued.
Have you read Beryl's Wikipedia page?
No.
Yes. So if you read Beryl's Wikipedia page, I mean, it really does sort of read like an Us magazine or a People. Gossip and speculation and scandal followed Beryl for the most of her days. It didn't hurt that she was 6 feet tall and looked like Greta Garbo, but also that she, forgive me, had sex like a man. And it is rumored that she had not only had an affair with the Duke of Gloucester, who was, you know, rumored to be the father of her child, but also Prince Edward, David, who abdicated the throne. And it's very likely that she did carry on with both of these men.
Talk about Beryl's son. What happened to him?
Jarvis was raised by Mansfield's mother. Mansfield's family had a lot of money and power and position, and basically Beryl was badgered away from Jarvis. He was also quite sickly as a child, and Mansfield's family had resources so they could take care of him. So Beryl didn't, in fact, raise her son, but neither did Mansfield raise his son. And interestingly enough, Jarvis, when he was interviewed later in his life, professed to quite a lot of affection for his mother. He admired her. He knew all about her accomplishments and admired and had a lot of affection for her.
Many people speculate on the fact that Beryl never gained as much fame as Amelia Earhart, for example. Why do you think that was?
Well, Amelia Earhart is America's sweetheart, and Beryl is a notorious woman. She really is. She's a notorious woman. She did all sorts of things that people simply didn't do, women didn't do. She made people uncomfortable. She wouldn't or couldn't follow the rules for her class or her gender. That is an iconoclast. She was a bad girl.
But we kind of loved her.
We do love her. And in this day and age, you know, she would be like a Lena Dunham figure or something, right? A riot girl. But in her own day, she was sort of too much, too ambitious, too independent. There really wasn't a place for her.
You know, I read in your biography that you had a project. You were writing a book on Marie Curie, but you left it. Might you ever return?
I'm not sure. You know, I worked on the Marie Curie novel for several years without finding the beating heart of it. I never really found the voice or the point of view that made things work. And in fact, when I found West with the Night, I was deep into that book and abandoned it. I never fell in love with that as a character in my own book.
Any final thoughts on the book?
No, only that. You know, so this is the second time I've written a novel about a real-life historical figure. And it seems to me an incredible privilege and an intimate act to take a woman who, for whatever reason, has been marginalized by history and bring her to the forefront and shine a light on her accomplishments and introduce her to a whole new generation of readers who might not be familiar with her life.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Elaine.
To hear a sampling of Circling the Sun, check bookreportradio.com, archive shows, week of August 8th, 2015. Isabel Allende's The Japanese Lover is an exquisite love story and a multi-generational epic. In 1939, as Poland falls under the shadow of the Nazis, young Alma Belasco's parents send her away to live with an aunt and uncle in their opulent mansion in San Francisco. There, as the rest of the world goes to war, she encounters the quiet and gentle son of the family's Japanese gardener. Unnoticed by those around them, a tender love affair begins. Following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the two are cruelly pulled apart as the young man and his family, like thousands of other Japanese Americans, are declared enemies and relocated to internment camps. Throughout their lifetimes, the two reunite again and again, but theirs is a love that they are forever forced to hide. Decades later, Alma is nearing the end of her long and eventful life. Irina, a care worker struggling to come to terms with her own troubled past, meets the elderly woman and her grandson, Seth. As Irina and Seth forge a friendship, they become intrigued by a series of mysterious gifts and letters sent to Alma. They begin to uncover an extraordinary secret passion that has endured for 70 years. Joanna Gleason performs the book.
He had arrived in Lark House with his third wife, but she had only survived for a few weeks before being run over in the street by an absent-minded cyclist. Frenchie's day began early. He took a shower, shaved, and got dressed with the help of Jean Daniel, his Haitian aide. He would make his way across the parking lot, leaning on his cane, keeping an eye out for cyclists, and continue to the corner Starbucks for the first of his 5 daily cups of coffee. Divorced once and twice a widower, he had never lacked lady admirers, whom he seduced with his magical charms. On one recent occasion, he had calculated he had fallen in love 67 times. He wrote the number down in his notebook so that he wouldn't forget it, as the faces and names of these lucky ladies were fading fast in his memory. He had several legitimate children, as well as one from a clandestine romance with someone whose name he couldn't remember, and any number of nephews and nieces, all of them ungrateful wretches who were only counting the days for him to depart this world so that they could inherit. There was talk of a small fortune amassed boldly and with few scruples. He himself admitted without the slightest hint of remorse that he had spent time in prison, where he had obtained the pirate tattoos adorning his arms, although flabby muscles, age spots, and wrinkles had blurred the images. He had also won considerable amounts speculating with the guards' savings. Although the attentions of several Lark House ladies left him little room for any amorous adventures, Jacques was fascinated by Irina from the first moment he saw her going around with her clipboard and pert behind. She had not a drop of Caribbean blood, which made her voluptuous backside even more of a feat of nature, he would tell everyone after his first martini of the evening, astonished that no one else had noticed it. He had spent his prime doing business between Puerto Rico and Venezuela, and it was then that he had become so keen on appreciating women from the rear. The epic buttocks of those distant days had become fixed forever in his mind's eye. He dreamed of them and saw them everywhere, even in such an unlikely spot as Lark House, and in someone as skinny as Irina. His aimless final days were suddenly filled with this belated, all-encompassing love that wreaked havoc with his tranquil routines. Soon after they met, he showed how besotted he was with the gift of a topaz and diamond scarab, one of the few of his dead wife's jewels that had escaped his descendants' clutches. Irina refused to accept it. But her refusal sent his blood pressure shooting sky high, so that she was forced to spend the whole night with him in the emergency ward. Hooked up to an IV drip, Jacques declared his undemanding platonic love for her, sighing and lamenting. He said he only wanted her company so that he could regale his eyes with her youth and beauty, hear her enchanting voice, and imagine that she loved him too, even if it was only like a father, or even a great-grandfather. The following evening back at Lark House, while Jacques was enjoying his ritual martini, Irina, her eyes red-rimmed and with dark circles beneath them from lack of sleep, went to find Lupita to confide the mess she was in. "There's nothing new about that child. We're always discovering the residents in someone else's bed, and not just the grandpas, the old women, too. You heard me. I swear it's true. I haven't seen it, but Frenchie demonstrated how it works to Jean Daniel. It's amazing. The good woman told Irina what she had observed during the many years she had worked at Lark House, that in itself, age doesn't make anyone better or wiser, but only accentuates what they have always been. A person who is tight-fisted won't become generous with age, Irina. They only become more miserly. I'm sure Divine was a rake, and that's why he's a dirty old man now.
That was a sampling of The Japanese Lover by Isabel Allende. Readers, so much to discover when we leave our literary comfort zones and go further afield. Check my website, bookreportradio.com, for scores of titles across the genres that will provide a very welcome escape from the season's hustle and bustle. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.